Final case for the afternoon is case number 55391, Christopher Floyd versus State.
Court, I'd like to reserve at least 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And you're ready to proceed for the appellant, Mr. Floyd.
Again.
Your Honor, it's a C. Conrad Clause, bar number 6601, appearing for the appellant. Essentially, well, we've got a series of potential attacks that can apply to the statute, and we raised them all. I think probably first and the most important issue is equal protection. Now, we talked in our brief about Romer. We also talked in our brief about Lawrence versus Texas. And if you look at those cases, it stands for a pretty simple proposition. That being that equal protection does apply, at least at a rational basis level, to the classification of homosexuality. And of course, when you look at the reasoning in Romer and in Lawrence, and also Scalia's dissent in both those cases, you see that you can't, and O'Connor's actual concurring opinion as well, it's quite clear that you can, when you're talking about behavior, you can't make a distinction between behavior and status with regard to at least sexual conduct. However, I think there's another important case to look at because it's probably controlling the situation right here, and that's Limon. Now, we went ahead and supplemented with that because, to be entirely frank, apology to the justices, we discovered that in a oral argument.
And that's a 2005 case?
It is a 2005 case, Your Honor. In what happened was in Kansas, we had a statute that was remarkably similar in some ways to the statute we're looking at here, 201.195. That statute was called the Romeo and Juliet statute in Kansas, but essentially what it did was it, when you had certain kinds of sexual crimes, if you were dealing with certain categories where there's an age range between the victim and the perpetrator, there was a downward departure. In other words, you got a break. You did not get a similar break if you were if it was homosexual conduct, only if it was heterosexual. In other words, if it was mixed gender, you got an application of the Romeo and Juliet statute. You did not get it if it was not. What happened was that Limon was decided roughly contemporaneous with Lawrence. And the appellate court in Kansas said, sorry, we affirm the lower decision. We can essentially, if you want to look at our statutory scheme, we can enhance crimes against crimes wherein both parties are of the same gender, homosexual crimes. And what happened then was they tried to appeal it to the Kansas Supreme Court, cert was denied there, and went straight to the United States Supreme Court. Now, it's significant what happened in the published decision, which we supplemented Your Honors with regard to Limon. The Supreme Court said three things. They said reversed, remanded, and come on, guys, go read Lawrence versus Kansas. Lawrence versus Texas, excuse me. In other words, they didn't think there was any discussion that was needed in this published decision other than read the case. It went back down to the it was remanded down and went to the Kansas Intermediate Court of Appeals, and they tried to make a distinguishing point, as the state has here, between where Lawrence talks about crimes dealing with minors. And they said, because we're talking, excuse me, children, that's the terminology the state's using here. It's also what they talk about in Lawrence. And the Kansas Supreme Court, in looking at it, said, no, that's not the way this works. When you make a distinction in such a matter, you are simply, again, attacking status. Now, in this case, what we have is a situation not where we have an adult and a minor, and if it's heterosexual conduct, you get one break, and if it's homosexual conduct, you don't get that break. Instead, we have a case where we can have a situation where there are people who are committing a crime in Nevada if it is same-gender conduct, and they're not committing a crime if it's heterosexual sex. What I mean by that is, now, and that's part of the problem with statute. I didn't want to get into the vagueness issue in our brief. The reason why we didn't is because it doesn't say that. In other words, if the state rewrote the statute, it doesn't pass equal protection muster no matter how they write it. There is no legitimate state interest, no non-targeted legitimate state interest, where you can target homosexual conduct and not heterosexual conduct. There's no proof, there's no data. And they make that clear in Romer. They make that clear in Lawrence. And so in that case, we're in a situation where vagueness really doesn't apply. It applies to the statute. It just isn't particularly controlling.
And Mr. Klaus, you think, if I understood you correctly, you believe the rational basis test applies and not the strict scrutiny. Is that correct? No.
Your Honor, that's pretty clear. Lawrence talks about two things. Due process, mm-hmm. which works here, mm-hmm. under Griswold. Essentially, it's a Griswold and Roe versus Wade line of cases. And then you have equal protection, which is Romer and also Lawrence.
I'm talking about equal protection. So you would concede it should be a rational basis scrutiny.
I concede it should be a rational basis scrutiny, and no less a learned authority than Justice Scalia in his dissenting opinion says that if rational basis does apply, and it does if you look at Lawrence, then any targeting like this, a specific group, doesn't pass muster. So, yes, I do believe it's simply a rational basis test, but I don't believe the state can, indeed the state has not, enunciated any reason why rational basis would work here. They can't say why there is any need for a statute that targets homosexual conduct but not heterosexual conduct in this
situation. Do you think perhaps that with a minor involved here in lewdness that it could be more traumatic to a minor to have be subjected to lewdness from the same gender than the opposite gender?
There's no data to suggest that. The state hasn't brought that up. So Polk applies. But no, mm-hmm. if you look at the amicus briefs mm-hmm. and the supporting documentation in Limon, in Romer, in Lawrence, there's no evidence to back that up. There's any particular damage to same gender conduct.
Mr. Klaus, a related question, perhaps it's almost a foundational question. Did the client waive the right to challenge, to
no.
make the challenge that you have?
No, Your Honor, he didn't. There's a couple of different issues. There's actually four issues that apply here. If we get past the issue that the state waived bringing it up under Polk, in an overabundance of caution, we brought it up in our opening brief. I don't think we needed to, but we brought it up just in case it was an issue that needed to be addressed. It was not. They waived arguing in any event. Here's the problem. First off, I'll point out as a starting point to that questioning that Lawrence versus Texas was also a plea deal. It was a no-contest plea that they took up to the Supreme Court like we are here. Secondarily, and more importantly, you can't waive the constitutionality of certain charges. We bring up Duffy and one other case, and I'm sorry I don't remember it right now, but it's in our brief on page 13, I think line 6, where what we talk about, Robert, if you pull that up, please, we can provide the court with those cases. The state has to acquire legal process in the first place, and they can't acquire legal process with an unconstitutional law. Thus, we never get to the point where you can waive it because they didn't have a right to charge it in the first place. Furthermore, while there were clear discussions with the prosecutor where we indicated that we were going to be bringing up the constitutionality of the statute, I don't think that we needed to do that. We also talk about that in the brief, but we mentioned it in front of the court that we intended to attack the constitutionality of that statute. But it's also clear, if you look at the case law that we bring up, that it is up that in this case, yeah, but excuse me, the other case is Perry, we brought up on page 13. But it's also, if it's not clear in the paperwork that the defendant waived it, we can't assume that he waived a constitutional right. We were talking about the vagueness of the statute. The problem is the statute, that is 201.195, says that it applies to minors. We don't know what a minor means. That's why I say it wouldn't even pass on a vagueness standard. A minor child is 201.015. In other words, In the 201 line of cases, they say minor child is somebody who is defined under NRS 129.0110 as somebody under the age of 18. They do not define minor anyplace. And I would like to point to you to 202.020-2060, where a minor is defined as somebody under the age of 21. So what we've got is a situation where we're not sure who falls into the statute. It is clear that somebody under the age of 18, if they have same-sex conduct with somebody who's over the age of 18, it's clear that if you have somebody under 18 and somebody over 21, that it applies. But does it apply if you have two people under the age of 18? There's a line of cases that say that it may not. Does it apply if you've got one person under the age of 18 and one person who's 19 or 20? Does it apply if you have one person who's 20 and one person who's 22? We don't know. But we do have the statute, because of its vagueness, you could have somebody who's 20 years old and has consensual same-gender sexual conduct with somebody who is 22, and they could be found to be looking at 5 years to life in prison. Five to 20, beg pardon. So it just is not clear. The state talks about a child. We're not talking about a child. We're talking about a minor, and we can't figure out what that is based upon the statute. It's not clear enough. Thank you.
You have 4 minutes and 41 seconds left. Mr. Fiddell, on behalf of the Nye County.
Your Honors, if it pleases the Court, Kirk Vitto, representing Nye County. I'm glad to be here this afternoon for my afternoon boring. Let's see. I want to address a couple things real quick that was brought out by the Court in regard to whether we should be here and the plea negotiation aspect of it. After reviewing the appellate's appendix, we did not attach one. Looking at the transcripts, I'm not so sure that the best way to resolve this isn't to vacate the judgment of conviction and remand the matter to the district court to either try the case or negotiate it. Whether the statute is unconstitutional, the manner in which we negotiated this case, there certainly was not a meeting of the minds. In the appellant's appendix, it records Mr. Klaus saying, and I don't remember what discussions Mr. Vitto and I had that led to it not being on the plea agreement. When I got my turn in the same transcript, I responded, that was not ever mentioned during the final negotiations of this case. It was never mentioned in Tonopah. It was never part of this agreement. As you can see, it's not in the agreement. At an early part of the negotiation process, when we were in Pahrump, it was brought up as something to include in the negotiation. On the day of trial, we were in the process of picking the jury. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, we had a jury, took a recess to negotiate the case, and the case was negotiated without mention of that being included as part of the negotiating process.
Did you just concede error? I thought that was what I heard.
I don't think you did. I'm not sure exactly what you said before about the case should be remanded back for a trial.
Well,
I think that's what Justice Tate is keen on.
Yeah.
All I can say is that there wasn't a meeting of the minds. I'm looking at the transcript, and I think it was most clearly articulated by defense counsel when he said, my client thought that when he entered this deal, he was preserving his right to challenge the constitutionality of the statute. Our goal at that juncture was to make it so that the family didn't have to go through this anymore, and so that they could get some closure, that we wouldn't have to be here.
Now, Mr. Vitto, again, we're trying to get this firm, just like follow up with what Justice Sadis said. If in your answering brief on this waiver issue, did you even address that?
Not even address it.
Okay.
Only brought it up because you asked.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading the plea agreement. It says, I understand that I will have a right to appeal any errors that may occur in my plea and sentencing errors, but I give up the right to appeal certain defects that may exist in my case at this point or might have occurred if I've gone to trial. So it sounds like you'd have an argument that this is a clear, unambiguous document, but you're saying you haven't raised that.
I did not raise it in my appeal. There was there was ambiguity. And
so you think it is ambiguous, this deal? I mean, you negotiate. We weren't there, so we got to trust you two gentlemen to tell us what the heck happened so we can try and get the right
result. I don't think
it was
ambiguous from my standpoint. Uh-huh. I negotiated the case for closure so that we wouldn't be here arguing anything. One of the other things that was brought up was, I think Justice Gibbons brought up if there was a more of an impact when it was perhaps homosexual in nature. We did have testimonies to that at the preliminary hearing stage. The particular stigma that attached as one of the victims was having some severe difficulty. In reviewing the history of this, the history of the legislation, obviously we all know that in 1986, Bowers laid down the law. In 2003, Lawrence changed it. 17 years later, I can't make an argument when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of this, the substantive issue. I can't make an argument that's not better articulated by the United States Supreme Court in Bowers or Justice Scalia in Lawrence. I can't make a better argument than what they've set forth. What I feel I have to do at this point, if we're going to reach that aspect of this argument, is to try and differentiate between what they were dealing with then and what we're dealing with today. I think the statutes are different. Obviously, the cases cited by the defense and Lawrence deal with same-sex consensual behavior in the privacy of their own home. That's not what we're talking about here. In fact, the statute makes criminal the solicitation to commit certain acts, anal intercourse, cunnilingus, and fellatio. It makes it a crime to solicit those acts, different than other statutes, because you don't even have to touch anybody. There doesn't have to be any physical contact to violate the provisions of the statute.
And does the statute make it clear whether or not it's the solicitation of a minor or the solicitation of a child?
It says minor, but obviously, at least I felt, minor is clearly synonymous with a child. If it's someone under 18, which it has to be.
We may all have our opinions about what is clear, but I guess my question would be, what does the statute tell us?
The statute does not define minor.
So it's not clear.
Well, a minor is someone under 18. If they're under 18, they're a child. So it makes criminal the solicitation. Touching is not necessary, and importantly, Judge Scalia pointed this out when he addressed the equal protection aspect of this argument in his dissent at Lawrence, and it's not always a comfortable thing to be able to have to stand before the court and argue a dissent, but he pointed this out, that it's actually homo-hetero-neutral, because you can be a heterosexual and solicit fellatio or cunnilingus or anal intercourse, except that would be with a male child. But either way, you can be a heterosexual and solicit these crimes. So at that point, it becomes neutral in that regard. Excuse me one moment. The statute, there's also the aspect that the statute hits exactly what it aims at, which is pedophilic behavior. If you have a person and a minor, this is about conduct, and that was addressed by Justice O'Connor alone as part of the majority decision in Lawrence. Justice Scalia picked up on that and carried it forward, that this statute addresses conduct and not necessarily a protected class. And, of course, one of the big differences is going to be that in Lawrence you dealt with a protected class, but you don't deal with a protected class here, because certainly no one is going to argue that a person has the fundamental right to solicit anal intercourse, cunnilingus, or fellatio from a minor. So it's clearly distinct and different from Lawrence in that aspect. I focused exclusively on Lawrence. The appellant clearly characterized that case as the controlling authority, calling it the precedential and seminal case. And Lawrence said that there was no rational basis for a law that infringed on a fundamental right. But there's no fundamental right here. There's no fundamental right, as I've said, to solicit the prescribed conduct from a minor. And this is on the substantive aspect of this issue, this is the only place that I can go. In the appellant's opening brief, page 10, beginning at line 17, they quote, "If protected conduct is made criminal and the law which does so remains unexamined for its substantive validity its stigma, right, might remain even if it were not enforceable as drawn for equal protection reasons. When homosexual conduct is made criminal by the law of the state, that declaration in and of itself is an invitation to subject homosexual persons to discrimination, both in the public and in the private spheres. And that takes me to the heart of my response. No one has a constitutionally protected right to do what the statute prohibits. This is not protected conduct, quote unquote, made criminal, quote unquote. This is not consensual same-sex sexual conduct between adults. I'm not so sure that those who supported the homosexual agenda wouldn't in fact support this law, because the law that this is protecting people from, it protects people from people that frankly negatively impact their argument. But that's why I referenced the quotes I did from Lawrence. The majority wrote that the case they were deciding did not involve minors or persons who might be injured or coerced, or who are situated in relationships, and this was important, at least factually as it came down in our case, where consent might not be easily refused. And this is from Lawrence. The court went on to elaborate upon that point by observing that, as they review the historical aspect that a substantial number of sodomy prosecutions and convictions were for predatory acts against those who could not or did not consent, as in the case of a minor or the victim of a minor or the victim of an assault, as to these, one purpose for the prohibitions was to ensure that there would be no lack of coverage if a predator committed a sexual assault that did not constitute rape as defined by criminal law, which actually happens to be part of the legislative intent, the history behind Senate Bill 305 that ultimately became NRS 201.195. Every case cited by the defense in support of their position in their opening brief dealt specifically with adult consensual acts. I know, sometimes I think about, I hear the argument we can't legislate morality. And I think to myself, well, we've decided that murder is immoral, and we've got laws against that. We've decided theft is immoral, and we have laws against that. Well, the legislature has decided that this conduct is something that a minor should be protected from. And so the legislature in the state of Nevada has made it a crime. I think that Judge Scalia's comments in that regard were important. He warned that he gave a warning to judges in his dissent not to take rides in a culture war, to take sides in a culture war. And he determined that this was best left to the people and the legislative branch of the government. And as he went through his discussion regarding a rational basis, a legitimate interest, it was pretty clear that we only needed to have a rational basis, that this would be a legitimate interest, and I can't make a better argument than the one he made in the dissent, or that Bowers made in their opinion, although Bowers is obviously overruled.
Any further questions, Justice Sater, Justice Gibbons? Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Claus, your rebuttal, 4 minutes and 41 seconds, please.
Mr. Claus, can I ask you this, based on what Mr. Bitto's comments were, is it your desire to vacate this judgment of conviction and start over on the plea negotiations, or what are we're kind of confused where we're at here today?
We're here on the constitutional validity of the statute. I think if you were looking at appropriate remedy, here's the problem. When this prosecution began, and every minute of this prosecution, the state was certainly on notice that these were unconstitutional charges. Indeed, we had several conversations about that. Mr. Bitto alluded to that, or actually explicitly said that. At that point, you have state misconduct. That means that what we need to do is go forward with the agreement with dropping off the constitutional charge. They don't get to go back and get a do-over. If they're going to go forward an unconstitutional charge with a statute of known fragility, for whatever reason, they bear the risk of that proceeding. The fact is, in this case, we had a plea agreement that the state was affirmatively recommending 24 to 60 and 10 to life, with us leaving up to the judge whether it was going to be consecutive or concurrent. We had a host of witnesses, our victim speakers, that came in and said they were instructed by the prosecutor to argue for the biggest sentence possible. We had a prosecutor that said we're arguing for essentially the minimums because my client's a bad guy. My client did horrible things. I could have brought that up, but frankly, I think them going forward with a known fragile statute, a statute that they knew was unconstitutional when the prosecution began, means they don't get a do-over. What we do is we vacate that portion of the sentence, and my client does 10 to life. In any event, does that adequately address the position, Your Honor?
I guess so.
Your Honor, the state brought up several things. First off, Limon, the case that we have in front of you, was dealing with non-consensual conduct. That was between an adult and a child, and the case was the statute was essentially struck down by the Supreme Court. It was also an adult and a child, homosexual versus heterosexual conduct. It's almost exactly the same as here, except we make it more of a crime. We make it a crime as opposed to enhancing a crime. With regard to the talk about the heterosexual conduct, let's talk about the fact. Let's talk about O'Connor's comments, where she says in her concurring opinion that instead the state maintains the law discriminates only against homosexual conduct. While it's true the law applies only to conduct, the conduct targeted by this law is conduct that is closely correlated to being homosexual. Under such circumstances, Texas sodomy law is targeted at more than conduct. It is instead directed towards gay persons as a class. Scalia also notes that point, even though he dissents from the opinion, he certainly notes that. With regard to looking at adequate coverage, we have plenty of coverage in this state for crimes against minors. We have made a decision that when an adult in a consensual situation deals with somebody under 14, whether we call it a child or a minor or whatever appellation we're going to apply, under the age of 14, we have statutory rape. That's the consent doesn't matter statute. You don't get to say consent doesn't matter when you're 14 if you're heterosexual, but if you're homosexual, it doesn't matter until you're 21 or 18, depending upon how we read this very vague statute. The only other point that we've got in my estimation, we talk about the fact that we talk about the morality of the statute. Justice O'Connor, in talking, in quoting from the Romer opinion, says in her concurring opinion, moral disapproval of a group cannot be a legitimate governmental interest under the Equal Protection Clause because legal classification must not be drawn for the purpose of disadvantaging the group burdened by the law. That's what we're dealing with here. This is so clear. It's Lawrence, Limon, and Romer are right on point. The only other thing we talked about was the meeting of the minds, and the waiver issue as well as meeting the minds. And I think Mr. Vito was talking about two separate things there. With regard to the waiver issue, I think I've addressed that. As I say, I don't think you can waive a constitutional claim of this nature. If you can waive it, my client didn't, and we certainly had a discussion with the court that he intended to appeal it. And that doesn't even get to the point that the state waived making any arguments by not doing so. They also waived any arguments talking about there not being a meeting of the minds, which is a contract law issue. But as I say, if you want to come into contract law and ask for an equitable solution, you must have clean hands. When you have prosecutorial misconduct that is going forward for whatever reason they decided to on a statute of known unconstitutionality, they can't turn around and then ask for a do-over. They have to suffer the consequences of going forward on a prosecution of that nature. Are there any questions, Justice?
Any questions, Justice Gibbons, Justice Sada? Thank you, Ms. Clements. This matter will stand submitted. The panel will thank